Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance to order. Let's start with the roll call.
Representative Cornish. Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howell.
Present.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger.
Ready to
serve. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay, we do have a quorum. Representative Dean, have you had a chance to check over the minutes from February 1st?
I have. So moved.
We have a motion to move, approve the minutes. All those, any changes? All those with approved. All those in the. Any think right now? Those should motion.
Oh, bad.
Should Rick, all those approved, say yes. Opposed? It's one of those, going to be an interesting day. Representative Chair Cornish is running a few minutes late. He'll get here as soon as he can. The minutes are approved. Today we have an overview on the Department of Corrections with Commissioner Tom Roy and Chief Financial Officer Chris Dodge. If we can get started. Commissioner Roy and CFO Dodge, welcome to the committee. If we can get started, if you can please state your name and your title and start with your overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I am Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. You've been notified that Chris Dodge, our Chief Financial Officer, to my right, will be assisting in the presentation and taking a primary role in the presentation. Deputy Commissioner Terry Carlson, to my left, will also be participating, and Ron Solhide, Deputy, will chirp in occasionally as well. We hope that this presentation will give you a clear understanding of our current state and give you a good understanding of our budget. And it only addresses, as we have been instructed today, to only discuss our current base budget. Yesterday we presented our requests for the next biennium, but we will avoid that conversation unless the chair or others ask specifically and if we have time. I just need to acknowledge some friends in Delaware who are dealing with a tragic prison situation this morning. An officer, corrections officer, was lost, a hostage. The other was recovered alive, and that is still unfolding, but it brings us into focus as to how important the work we do is and what our staff deal with every day and the potentials they deal with every day. And it's a sad moment in corrections, and it is just a sad moment. So we'll proceed, and we will try to liven up this conversation as much as we can with the budget. Sure. Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Roy, that's the situation I was watching as well on the news last night and following on the Internet. It's a tough situation. I have a lot of sympathy for the families and for the individuals involved and for the corrections officers and all the other law enforcement officers on the scene there. I believe Representative Hilson, you had a question?
I did, Mr. Chair. So my question, first, I am sorry for what is going on. That is a very difficult time for everyone in this industry. But my question is, who told you not to present anything about the budget, the proposed budget going forward, and how is it that we're just talking about the base budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that is the chair's, when he set the agenda for this meeting, apparently that was the instruction. I was not present for that discussion, and we've prepared for that. And my guess is that, my hope is that we will return for the more comprehensive request budget.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, it is the intent of the chair to have them back for that part.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern is that we currently have the very powerful Ways and Means chair currently sitting at the table, and this may be our opportunity to influence what it is that the Ways and Means chair believes that we need to do in this area. So, Mr. Chair, I hope that you will not preclude us from asking questions as those issues arise, because we want to capitalize on the opportunity to influence what budget numbers may come to the department based on the attendance today.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, you may see the Ways and Means Chairman again.
Yeah, the Ways and Means Chair does have a way of floating around and getting to everywhere. Commissioner Roy, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, you will see in this budget presentation that we have a heavy people orientation. We deal with thousands of people as our offender population, and we employ thousands of people. We hence have many people-related costs, but we truly believe that people change people. We just do not simply turn the keys and lock people up in our prisons. We have programs in our prisons. We have programs and opportunities in our community programming for people to change. And I think we are under a heavy obligation and a mandate from the public to make a difference in the people that we have in our care. And we take our mission very seriously, and in my presentation to you, the overview of the department, the last time we appeared in front of you, we focused on the mission, and our mission is to reduce future crime. And every effort we do, every dollar we spend, is related to that mission. We have far too many victims who are suffering in our communities. A number of people just this week attended the domestic abuse violence femicide rollout of their report, their annual report, and I know some of you folks were present during that rollout. Domestic violence, terrible, and impacting children and families, and we have hundreds of offenders in our prisons and under supervision that are related to domestic violence, and I think it's very important that we address that important subject, especially this week. So with those comments, I'll turn it over to Mr. Dodge. Mr. Dodge has been, his work in this area is totally focused, and as the chief financial officer for our organization, he has a detailed knowledge over the course of many, many years in his position, not only in this administration, but he also served in the previous administration in this capacity. So he is very, very knowledgeable.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Dodge, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Corrections. And I just want to take a moment to thank you for the opportunity to present this budget overview, and thank you, Commissioner, for your kind remarks. So most of the information in this presentation reflects the budget for the current fiscal year, that is for fiscal year 2017, unless it's otherwise noted. The funds for the DOC are appropriated by program or division. We have three divisions in our agency: correctional institutions, community services, and operations support. Our general fund budget is nearly $555 million, and we pay for over 4,100 FTEs. Our budget represents 2.5% of the state's total general fund budget, and 96% of our budget is comprised of the general fund. The chart on the left shows budget by percentage allocated to each division. Correctional institutions is by far our largest division. And the chart on the right shows staffing by percentage allocated to each division. And you can see there that our staffing is, we are very staff intensive, as the commissioner noted. The charts on this page show a little bit more breakdown of our total budget. 14% of our general fund budget is passed through to our community partners for offender supervision and probation. Excluding that pass-through funding, almost three-fourths of our budget pays for employee compensation. So before we move on to more budget detail, I'd like to take the opportunity to talk a little bit about our per diem. This graphic represents the average adult operational per diem for fiscal year 2016. That's the most recent year with complete expenditure data. It costs $92.14 per offender per day on average to have an adult offender in a correctional facility. The largest component, of course, is security, but you can see from this that there's a lot more than just that. Physical health represents medical and nursing services. Physical plant operations would include things like utilities, maintenance, and repairs. Behavioral health would include sex offender treatment, chemical dependency treatment, and mental health services. And offender services would include things like clothing, linens, cleaning supplies, paper supplies, mattresses, etc. But it also includes a very important case management service component. Each offender is assigned to a case manager to help them and to help us, really, with their prison experience and to help prepare them for their transition from prison to the community when that time comes. As depicted earlier, our largest division is the Correctional Institutions Division, with a total general fund budget of about $403 million. And 3,500 FTEs. This chart shows the various activities within that division. We'll go into more detail on some of them later on. This is just a slide that shows all of our correctional facilities, where they're located. It identifies the budget for each of those facilities and the offender capacity. It should be noted the budgets shown on this slide do not include offender health care or offender education. Those budgets were centralized several years ago, and so they're not included in this budget. But on the next slide, we added those things back in. So as I said, this chart shows the average cost of an adult facility. And to show a more complete picture, we've added back in those health care expenditures and those education expenditures.
Mr. Dodge, I believe Representative Hillsman has a question on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So where would I find a breakdown of which programming is offered at which facility? You know, for example, does all of your facilities have treatment available and all types of treatment? Or is that only at specific facilities? Do all inmates have access to chemical dependency treatment, or what percentage does? Is that in this presentation? Is it in the budget book, or is it somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that is not in this presentation. We can certainly get that data for you, but you are correct. The services provided vary by each facility. We have some facilities like Lino Lakes that is more treatment-rich, and we have other facilities that don't have as much. So,
Mr. Bash, please continue.
Mr. Chair, this particular slide on page 8, I think is important. I know there's been some discussions around the table about what it costs to operate a prison, and this slide represents a pretty generic view of what the budget is and the kind of staff complement that it would take to run a prison of about 1,000 inmates. And as a reference slide for future discussions, I think it might be useful to committee members. I think it clearly reflects an average, and we have prisons that are smaller and we have prisons that are bigger, but a 1,000-bed facility is pretty common. So thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, so this is the average Minnesota numbers. It doesn't take into account any comparison with other states. And do we then know what these numbers would be for how each of our prisons, whether they're above average or below average, based on the previous slide?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, compared to a national average?
Compared to the average that you have put on slide number 8.
Commissioner Roy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, I might not be tracking. It sounds like Deputy Carlson is tracking you perfectly.
Good.
Deputy Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, this is the average of our 10 facilities, so some of them do have treatment and some do not, and this just takes all of that combined and divides it so that when looking at a facility of about 1,000, as our commissioner said, these would be our average costs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nielsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's great. I just want to drill down into your individual facilities. So I just want to compare each of your folks, which is why I asked the previous question. I know you probably don't have it in the presentation now, but if we could have that follow-up conversation so that I can see. I mean, certainly we have some that are doing better than others, and there are some that have more structural needs than others. And when you get a nice average number, it doesn't really give a very good overall picture of where the needs are. I'm kind of laying the foundation for the governor's budget is what I'm doing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pilstrom, you're absolutely right. And, for example, at our Oak Park Heights facility, we have an intensive need for health care staff for our transitional care unit and our mental health unit. And so each facility does have their unique needs and issues. Some of our facilities are very old, and so utility costs may be higher because they're not as energy efficient and all of those things. So you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
Where are we at? Morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Representative Frankie had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to add to what Representative Hilstrom was saying. If you could get us that information on a per-facility basis, but also I would ask to also include things like education opportunities, the things that will allow people to be successful once they get out, those type of programs that are also offered on a breakdown by certain facilities.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wouldn't be surprised if you would see that information by the end of the day.
Thank you.
And Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually going to ask for the same thing in terms of services for each one of them, but also if you could identify the population, because that's going to trigger what the services are. So a real breakdown of each of the units would help us understand better what the needs are and where to set priorities. Thank you.
Representative Beckerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, to clarify, I think it would be helpful to know more data as far as race and, you know, how that all breaks out between the different facilities and what's available at each facility.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. So to continue, as I was saying, this slide does show a more complete picture because we have added back in those health care and education expenditures. The average annual budget for an adult correctional facility is $33.1 million, and the average offender population is 946 offenders. And just to touch on the previous points, we do have the data by facility, and we will get that back to you. So continuing with the average adult facility, the average staffing complement for an adult facility is 316 FTEs. And you can see here how the FTEs are allocated within a correctional facility. This next slide provides additional detail on our health care budget. It's an annual budget of $81.5 million with 536 FTEs. We have a blend of contracted medical services and state employees who provide nursing services and treatment services. Just touching on the mental health services portion of it, unfortunately, it's not sufficient to address to meet all the needs of our offender population, all the mental health needs for our offender population. The contracted medical services include things like on-site primary care, pharmacy costs, psychiatry, and utilization reviews, while the nursing wedge is just that. It's nursing services. The health services budget is currently being challenged due to the nationwide trend of rising health care costs.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as I said earlier at the opening of the meeting, we did present at the Senate yesterday the governor's budget, and Deputy Carlson had significant comments about pharmacy costs and rising mental health concerns in our population, and the Star Tribune actually carried a very comprehensive reporting of that testimony, and some of you may have read that in the morning paper, but that would give a bit of detail about what Mr. Dodge was just talking about, the growth of and the challenge that we have in the medical area. That's pretty significant. We experience it just like the general population is experiencing medical issues right now as well.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you could tell me in what category, and I thank you for mentioning domestic violence, where the batter intervention type, is that in the education segment, or are you putting that in the mental health services segment?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, domestic abuse treatment overlaps a lot of our other treatment programs, and right now we have an initiative to break out domestic abuse treatment specifically, and our victim advocate director, Lydia Newland, is very engaged in domestic violence issues, and we have adjusted our visiting policy for domestic violence victims. We have right now are giving it a lot of attention, recognizing the lethality of this issue. Some domestic violence cases end up, as I said earlier, in tragic ends.
Thank you.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious as to those that are coming through, about what percentage of them have committed a domestic violence assault?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think in our overview that we presented last week, we had the actual numbers of the enhanced domestic violence cases that we have, and I think it's around 600 that are currently inside, but in our survey of other offenders for other offenses, it is a component of their lives significantly, and I think we could easily double that number of our 10,000, and Deputy Carlson will have that specific for you in a moment.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, of course, I always ask the same questions, too, kind of percentages of those coming through the courts. I think you talked about the chemical dependency was around 85 to 90%, which is a consistent number I've heard for every term I've been here. And then we talked a little bit last time you were here about mental health, and so I'd like to get that number is a little bit closer to the severe and persistent mental health, if you could just remind us of what that was. And I'm assuming a lot of this is dual diagnosis types of things, because if you've got 85-90% that have a chemical dependency and they also have domestic violence issues and they also have mental health issues, you've got a dual diagnosis across the board there. But just to help us understand the population a little bit better and the treatment challenges, if you could just speak to that just ever so briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, people that walk in our doors have multiple issues, and many of those issues present themselves very early in life. The remedies for those issues often don't occur or are available till much later in life, unfortunately. And those that are walking in our prison doors, as you have correctly stated, have pretty significant chemical abuse or chemical addictions. Lots of our younger offenders are coming out of traumatic home situations, homes of violence, homes of economic struggles. And during the course of their human development, if those mental health and trauma issues are not dealt with, they often present themselves as crimes and criminal behavior. So when we develop treatment programs, it's very difficult for us to develop programs that are very singular in nature. Sex offenders, for instance, we obviously focus on sexual behaviors, but when we look at if the totality of their circumstance, sex offenders often have other criminal activity in their lives. And they, upon release, sex offenders, for instance, have one of the lowest recidivism rates for sexual activity, but their recidivism rates for other crimes comes up to about an average amount. So when we deal with all of the people in our facilities and in our communities, we have to look at all those multiple issues, because they are weaved very tightly sometimes, as you know. And in regard to your question earlier about the felony domestic abuse clients currently inside, July of 15, 277. And that is as the result of new felony domestic abuse laws and enhancements. So, and felony stalking, and often related to domestic violence, another 322, up from 44 in 2000. So we have about 600 domestic violence-related crimes inside.
Representative Beckerson.
Just on that point, I just wanted to clarify, there are other felony-level domestic violence-related offenses that would go into that number, and these numbers that you're talking about right now are the enhanced ones and the stalking ones that wouldn't include strangulation or, you know, some of the other felony-level domestic offenses, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, I think the strangulation statute added much to this number. So I can't speak. We have general categories, and I can't break those out on this particular chart. So I'm sure you are correcting in that field.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence. You had touched ever so briefly on trauma, and that's something that I think is a fairly new topic when we're talking about treatment with offenders. Can you just, have you done a survey as to how many folks have experienced childhood trauma? And can you speak about that just a little bit, and maybe some of your initiatives that you're dealing with, trauma-based therapies?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have done trauma surveys on specific populations, and especially our juvenile population, our American Indian population, female offender population, and depending on how you define trauma, it is almost a universal experience with our female population. And for our juvenile population that are presenting themselves very early with criminal behavior, it's almost 100% also. Trauma includes, for those that aren't familiar with the topic, witnessing violence, and that can be witnessing violence in the streets. It can be more commonly witnessed in their homes in terms of domestic abuse, children looking at it, and trauma can relate to having an actively addicted parent who is trying to raise a family. Those traumatic situations often lead to addictions themselves, and of course lots of discussion about the trauma of early sexual abuse and how that can lead to future sexual abuse as a victim and as a perpetrator. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that when kids see terrible things, life loses hope, motivation for success declines, and it's very easy to fall into a life of addiction and crime. And unfortunately, trauma does that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Mr. Chair, I just have a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about some of the trauma-based therapy things that you're actually starting to integrate into your therapy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have been out of the therapy of particular individuals, but I know Deputy Carlson has been very active in integrating that into our programming.
And then if we could, after that, bring back the discussion to finance matters. We're getting a little delve into policy here, and our instructions were for you folks to deep dive into the budget here before you came. So go ahead.
Mr. Deputy. Chair, Representative O'Neill, thanks for the question. Yes, we are using the tenets of trauma-informed care. As the commissioner said, at our Red Wing facility, very, very heavily. Our treatment providers and our mental health staff also are using trauma-informed tenets, and it's, as you said, becoming more and more of a emerging and current topic amongst our general population. And so, as with domestic violence, we're incorporating those tenets into our current practices. We don't have a specific program related, but with our integrated case management processes, we're looking more at whole person, and that includes history. An example, at Shakopee, we're starting to survey people who come into that women's prison to find out if they have had experience with sex trafficking, mm-hmm. because they need some special attention in that area. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to bring you back to the budget. Can you tell me, based on your current financial situation, what percentage of the population actually gets access to chemical dependency treatment and sex offender treatment, and do you know how much money you would need in order to actually provide treatment just even to the ones that are court-ordered to get it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, we have been using, as a part of our budget presentations, 30% are getting the needed treatment. and we can detail that for you in a future presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the next budget set that's coming, are you asking for additional treatment beds, and will that move that number from 30% to some other number?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilsmer, we have some requests related to mental health treatment, yes. I should say behavioral health.
Okay, proceed, sir.
Okay, so while the education budget is only 2.2% of the correctional institution's general fund budget, it's certainly important in terms of the services it provides. You can see here that the budget is pretty complex. Only about half of the education budget it comes from the general fund appropriations. We receive a significant amount of money from the Minnesota Department of Education for adult basic education. We receive some federal funds, and we invest some MinCorp funds into this program, programs.
On that subject, we had a visit from Commissioner Franz and somebody, what was the other? It was about the study that was done on corrections that I think you were part of. And it was interesting. Some of the things they listed had no effect and a theoretic effect, and then and success. And they didn't label the education program real high in there. Are you familiar with that? Or as far as positive effect, the basic education, a portion of the corrections?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am very familiar with the results. First study, as we participated in that, the impact of education, we feel, is that it's a positive activity while they are in our institutions, and the direct recidivism reduction is the only measure that was used for the study that you referenced, and we recognize that the success of people isn't always measured by recidivism. I think there probably is not any person in this room that would say a GED or a high school equivalency hurts people. I think our notion is that, as we have all experienced our education, we see that it's a positive activity, and for those that are engaged in education, in our institutions, generally have a positive view of the future, and we support education. I think it's a common value amongst all of our citizens, and it prepares people beyond our dealing with them. It prepares people, if they choose, for advanced career development, post-secondary education, and I think you will find the research that you referenced. Post-secondary education does, in fact, reduce recidivism and the likelihood of employment, and we see those as positives. But you are right, it didn't have the effect that other programming does.
Yeah, in fact, I think they rated MinCorp higher than on the effect on recidivism than they did the education piece. But we should get together sometime and talk about that, because it was interesting to finally have a study that rated the different aspects of a treatment and education and everything, and how it might affect your budget in the future. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not familiar with that study, but I have actually seen several back when I was doing that kind of work that said education was the single biggest factor, a rise in a level of education to combat recidivism. And I've seen that in a couple of studies. Number two was alcohol and drug treatment, and can't remember what the third one is, but the single highest one was education.
And therefore the problem with studies. All right. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Okay, so now we'll move on to our community services division, the second largest division in our agency, representing about 22% of our total agency budget. While this division is most widely recognized for managing and supporting the supervision of offenders in the community, you can see here the budget supports a variety of very important responsibilities. A couple things to note. Grants and subsidies, we have more information on the following slides. Just to touch a little bit on DOC probation and supervised release and special supervision, we're responsible for the supervision of about 20,000 offenders in the community, adult supervision in 54 counties, adult misdemeanor and juvenile probation in 28 counties, intensive supervised release supervision in 75 counties, and intensive supervision for CIP offenders in 82 counties, excuse me. Often these caseloads for these are 2 to 3 times the recommended standards. And the only other note I'll make on this slide
Sorry for interrupting. Representative Ward, I want to get too far down the line before we let him ask questions. Go ahead, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how this fits into this community service or where it fits in the budget, but my understanding is that sex offenders, particularly pedophiles, have tried to and wanted help before they actually offended and often could not find a service that would help them. How do we address that? Is that somewhere in these services that you're talking about? And if so, if offenders want the service and can't get it until after they've offended, how can we do some better interventions on that?
Whichever commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, Ron Solhay, Deputy Commissioner of the Community Services Division. We will get into that a little bit more in a later slide here, but offenders on supervision in the community are eligible for outpatient sex offender treatment. We do have funding in our budget, and we do support that outpatient sex offender treatment, essentially statewide, through 19 contracted vendors. And some of the costs are borne by our funding. Some offenders have insurance that covers that cost. And our funding is primarily for those that do not have adequate insurance to cover the cost of that outpatient sex offender treatment.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. Just to clarify, is there a service, so a community service or some kind of outreach service available to people who have not offended yet, so they're not in the system, but they want help. They recognize they have a problem and they want help before they hurt someone.
Mr. Chair, sure. Representative Ward, that would not necessarily be through our agency. through Department of Human Services would probably be the proper route for those individuals.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. The only other note I had on this slide was the community-based reentry services include things like work release and our institution community work crews and reentry services.
Representative Hillstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you tell me, I know that we're housing a number of offenders in county jails, and I don't know how many those are, but those that are being housed in the county jail, are they receiving the reentry services that they would otherwise get if they were being housed at the Department of Corrections?
Commissioner?
Chairman Cornish, Representative Hillstrom, we have about 320 that are housed in county jails currently with our what we call our housed out of facility unit. The majority of those offenders, if they are with us for any length of time, would be coming back to our facilities for release, being eligible for pre-release classes that we do offer at all of our facilities. There are some offenders that are housed there that are on a very short time frame, which would not be eligible for those services because they wouldn't have time to actually be engaged in that programming.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many are we housing out of state?
Commissioner?
State. I don't.
You could just get that for me at a different date. I'm fine with that. I just would like to know how many we're housing in different states.
We'll have that in a few moments.
Okay, begin.
So the next slide you have available there shows, like the chart indicates, about 61% of our funding in community services is pass-through funding that we manage. These are the largest areas of pass-through funding. The first one on the graph here, 62, just a little over $62 million is funding that is passed through to the Community Corrections Act counties. There are 33 counties that are part of the Community Corrections Act. They provide all of the correctional supervision in their counties, so probation, supervised release, parole for misdemeanants, adults, felons, adult felons, and juveniles. You'll see there's one line here that talks about intensive community supervision. Six of those CCA jurisdictions also provide the intensive supervised release supervision in their jurisdictions, and we provide the funding for those corrections agents.
Commissioner, Representative O'Neill had a question. Order, are you done with that? Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, within that budget, does that also cover someone that has relapsed in their recovery and has had a technical violation? I know we've talked quite a bit about technical violations. Does that cover treatment for them as opposed to being sent back to the prison? You showed us that chart where 64% of those that are coming back in to the prison are actually through technical violations. And so I'm just wondering, is there an option for them to actually receive treatment in the community as opposed to going back to prison? And is that paid for by the DOC budget?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, those offenders in the community are eligible to receive services such as treatment, not through the Department of Corrections budget, but if they qualify, as example, through the Consolidated Treatment Funds, and they can find a bed that's available, that is an option for some of those offenders. And that would be typically through a restructure process. So rather than a revocation and a return, they would be restructured, directed to have a chemical use assessment, and then if that assessment showed they were in need of chemical dependency treatment, they would be eligible to take advantage of that in the community through a restructure process.
Okay.
The next section is county The next line is county probation offices. These are our county partners in 26 counties. The county probation offices provide supervision to adult misdemeanants and juveniles in those 26 counties. The next slide gets to, we have a variety of other funds available, and this gets to some of Representative O'Neill's questions about what other services may be available. As example, the first line talks about remote electronic alcohol monitoring. Offenders who are directed to be on alcohol monitoring at the county level, there is funding through the DOC that's available for those indigent offenders that cannot afford that alcohol monitoring. So we have, through our grants and subsidies unit, funding available for that. We have outpatient sex offender treatment. I mentioned that earlier. We have $2.4 million currently available to provide for sex offender outpatient groups throughout the state, and we contract with 19 providers and cover pretty much the entire state. It is somewhat of a challenge, though, because transportation issues and other barriers exist. So this is an area that that we continue to work with our treatment providers to expand the opportunities as much as possible. We have funding available for transitional housing, so offenders exiting prison who have needs for housing because they do not have the resources or a potential residence to reside in. We have some contracted housing that are actually leased homes through a service that we utilize to provide for some short-term transitional housing, as well as halfway house beds in the larger metropolitan areas. The next line is ancillary services to enhance supervision. Again, halfway house beds for primarily our predatory offenders, those level 2 and 3 sex offenders that are exiting from prison without a residence, gives them an opportunity to secure a residence and employment as they are releasing. And this also covers the majority of our costs for electronic monitoring, both standard electronic monitoring and GPS monitoring. We have about 220 offenders on any given day on electronic monitoring, including GPS. We have emergency housing funds, which are available primarily on a short-term basis for offenders who go out and maybe struggle, do not have enough rent money to cover their housing for a couple of weeks. We have some funding that's available to the offenders that are out in the community to cover that. We provide funding for polygraph testing, again, for offenders in sex offender treatment. We have reimbursement funds that go out to the counties when assessments are ordered by the court. These are oftentimes fairly expensive, so we have some funding to reimburse for those services. The last two lines here, reentry and halfway houses. The $300,000 was approved last legislative session, and what this is basically halfway house services, but requires a county match. We let out an RFP on this, and we had three counties that applied for these funds, and will provide the matching dollars for this.
Commissioner Representative Johnson has a question.
Mr. Chair, this question is probably going to be for Mr. Dodge, dealing with the grants. A number of years ago, and it wasn't that many years ago, the Department of Corrections used to have some grant funding to assist the counties in jails in building and remodeling jails. If I recall, my first year down here, I was informed about, talked a little bit about that, but that program was dropped because nobody was using it anymore. And now with some of the changes in the regulations where at the county level, what the Department of Corrections has put into place, where a 100-bed facility is considered full at 70 beds because of classification requirements. We have number of counties now that are having to expand and remodel their jails. What I'm wondering is when that program was dropped, if the money was absorbed into DOC, or was it just completely removed and the money was no longer allocated? And if you could get that information to me offline, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, in the past, we had funding through the Juvenile Jail Removal Program back in the 1990s, and it was specific to providing funding for the construction of juvenile facilities around the state, 8-day temporary holdover facilities, 24-hour temporary holdover facilities, and some juvenile detention-type facilities that were constructed at that time. I started with the department in the Inspection and Enforcement Unit back in 1988, and in all of that time, we've never had funding for county jail projects, remodeling, or construction. So we can do a little more research on that, but we have not had funding for county jails for any of those purposes.
Okay, Commissioner.
The last one is the $1 million line there that we received funding for last year to operate two hub centers, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, for high-risk release offenders in the community, and those hubs are in the process of getting up and running to provide a variety of services to those individuals, including housing, cognitive behavioral programming, mentoring services, and those will be up and operational in the very near future.
So our third and final division is the Operations Support Division, representing approximately 5% of our agency's total general fund budget. The units in this division really help ensure that all other agency operations run smoothly. We provide services to 10,000 incarcerated offenders, over 4,300 employees, and 20,000 offenders on supervision in the community. It's important to note that many of the employees in this division are located at other locations, many of them in our correctional facilities. For example, finance staff, HR staff are located in four regional locations for the 10 correctional facilities. Record staff are located at a centralized location in a facility. The greatest challenges in this division in terms of budgetary concerns and staffing resources really is in the information technology unit, where we really need more resources.
Mr. Chair, to that issue, Minute provides much of our and all of our services. We have some, and I think everybody around the table knows that the governor and Minute have devoted a lot of conversation to the security and how the technology is so important to our business operations. So I just need to emphasize that information technology is central to criminal justice. Without information exchange, criminal justice disappears.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are any of the IT employees internal to the Department of Corrections, or are they all, how does that work, all Minute employees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, the way it works now is they are Minute employees, and they are assigned to our agency. Mm-hmm. So we call them, for example, Minute at DOC employees. So, but Minute is responsible for their salaries, and they, in turn, charge us a rate. So.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Representative Ward.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that a little bit, with the changing technology, I'm not sure that I could ask you to make a comparison of what your costs were before Minute and what they are now, but if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Dodge. Representative, Assistant Commissioner Wojcik is an expert in this area and has served before Minute and after Minute, and I'm hopeful she will give you an astute answer.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Lisa Wojcik. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Operations Support. Representative Ward, at this point, our costs have maintained the same since we have gone to Minute. We have an excellent partnership with that agency, and they have provided us levels of service that we were not able to obtain on our own. There, as the Commissioner alluded, and it's public information, we do have a request, however, for an increase for Minute, and that will include money for technical debt. Our agency has, our division of operations support has taken a lot of hits in the past. For the last 6 years, we've been pretty safe, but we've taken a lot of budget cuts in this division, and IT was one of the areas that has suffered greatly, and we've never had the base funding to pay for the technology infrastructure that we've needed. So we're talking about servers and computers and telephone and all those kinds of things. So we will talk about that a little bit more next week when we're back.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little off topic, but it's technology, and you might be the right technology person to ask this question. We have seen in our local counties that it's getting more and more expensive and more dangerous when they are transporting inmates. Especially when you're dealing with folks who have serious and persistent mental illness issues. Do you have the technology capability to do court appearances through ITV? And if the court and the public defenders and the counties can get a program going, do you have the technology support that you would need to allow them to appear in court from your facilities?
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
Representative Hillstrom, we do have ITV technology in all of our facilities, and there were some pilot efforts, I believe, with Anoka, if I remember, a couple years ago. and the public defender was part of that conversation as well. To tell you the truth, I've not had an update on those pilots, but we do use ITV for internal purposes, parole hearings, some discipline hearings between our central office and institutions. But I think it might be a bigger issue with the courts than it is with us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, previously, the public defenders had been a hang-up. They've assured me this year that they are not going to be a hang-up. So I wanted to make sure that in the event they are interested in going that direction, that you had the capability to do it.
Okay, Mr. Dodge, or whoever would like.
Okay, so as I mentioned very early in the presentation, 96% of our budget comes from the general fund, and 4% comes of our operating budget comes from other funds. And this is just a list of the general categories for those other funds. Special revenue funds, they're used for specific purposes. We collect money for a specific purpose and have to expend it for that specific purpose. They represent approximately 3% of the agency's operating budget. A good example of this is the ABE money that comes from the Minnesota Department of Education. It comes to us for adult basic education, and we need to spend it for adult basic education. Federal funds account for less than 1% of our operating budget, approximately $3 to $5 million a year. And they come mostly from formula grants or competitive grants from the federal government. Correctional Industries Fund, MNCOR, they have a revolving fund. They have sales, I believe, a little over $40 million a year. They have net come that averages, I think, about $4 million a year in recent years. And that money is reinvested into the MNCOR operations and also pays for some infrastructure. And some of it goes towards some offender programming for reentry and education. And the final one is social welfare funds, and that's really the offender's money that we hold for them as their custodian. So.
Commissioner. Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that there have been some lawsuits that have been going on about the cost that inmates pay for telephone services. Can you tell me, have you addressed the issue with what inmates pay for the use of the telephone here in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair. Yes. Representative Hillstrom, our phone costs for offender phone calls are 5 cents a minute now. We made that change a while back when we believed the FCC ruling was going to be in effect, and that is lower than what was going to be implemented by the FCC. So, you know, our research shows that when inmates have connections with their family through visiting and other means, that recidivism is reduced. And it's really important for our offenders to be able to make phone calls to their family members. And so we believe that was the right thing to do, not just because the FCC was going that direction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the last thing that I have is, what is the charge that you the department gets for administrating the books of offender money? Do you have a flat fee that you charge? Is it different depending on the facility? Is it free?
Mr. Dodge?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we do offender banking for all of our offenders, and they are not charged for that service.
Okay. Commissioner. Well, we've got you stopped here. The average daily cost of incarcerating an adult offender on your slide 5, how do your totals and the grand total compare to average per diem costs in other states or on the national average? Is there a way, I imagine some of them are maybe apples to oranges, but is there a way that you can compare to some to see how we're doing in comparison to some states that are like us?
Mr. Chair, there is a way to make those comparisons. From my research, and we can get very specific because there are think tanks that do that work, compare state to state, Bureau of Justice Statistics, Q, Council of State Governments have all done that kind of cost analysis, and we will definitely provide you that list. But I would say 92 is in the high medium. We aren't the highest, and we certainly aren't the lowest. I think the lowest I have seen is about $32 a day, and the highest is, I think, around 110, 115, and those would be the Northeast states.
Which of those items do you think stands out as compared to other states that we are higher in, if you had to pick one?
Well, we certainly have aging facilities. We clearly behavioral health. Some states are really skinny on what they provide for treatment for people on the inside. Many states, they just turn the key and both and let them out. So behavioral health adds to our system. Our food costs are very comparable. Generally, we're really skinny on overhead. Our operations support is a percentage of budget. The one statistic I have told you in the past is that we are on the bottom five of all states in terms of the percentage of general fund devoted to corrections. So, and that relates, of course, to our small population, and it relates to the big population in other states. But we are, the investment we make in our industry and in our education and the daily activities of our offenders keeps them busy. And when you keep people busy, you keep staff safe. You keep offenders safe, and I think our research shows that the return on investment is significant.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. And proceed. Oh, we have Representative Pinto has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is another question that, just as long as we're paused, asking about the health services slide. This popped into my head. I understood you saying that 30% of inmates or offenders are receiving needed chemical dependency treatment. And so I guess one initial question is just, is that true for behavioral health or for mental health more broadly, that, you know, so 70% are not receiving needed treatment, if I'm understanding what you said before?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, all of the offenders who need mental health services because they're seriously and persistently mentally ill do receive services. We could absolutely do better, more comprehensive, longer duration during the day kinds of services, and when we do our budget presentation, you'll get more of that information in a change item.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I guess what I'm trying to get to or just think through as I think about what you said before and look at this slide is, you know, we traditionally made a distinction in our society between different kinds of health and prioritizing physical health over mental health. And so when I heard that comment of 30% getting needed chemical dependency treatment, implying 70% don't, and I'm thinking that, you know, it probably isn't the case that 70% of offenders, if they have a broken bone or have some physical ailment, that's true in a lot of areas. And I don't know if you can sort of comment about that, because that, you know, we do prioritize physical health over mental health, and it seems to be reflected in what I'm seeing here, if you can comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, yesterday I commented to the Senate group that the classification of mental health relates to that statistic. So if you include chemical dependency as a mental health issue, that is really where our treatment deficit is. And what Deputy Carlson was referring to are those that are diagnosed with significant and persistent mental illness. Those folks are getting treatment, and we believe it's a better care than they would be getting in the community, probably. So the gap in those numbers primarily relates to chemical dependency as a mental illness as well. And we just, while we are the largest deliverer of chemical dependency in the state, we have about 1,000 people that are in chemical dependency treatment at any given time. We have 10,000 people inside, and if you do the math on my previous comment, about 90% have chemical dependency issues, whether that's dependency or abuse. We could do a lot better.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So recognizing so 90% have chemical dependency issues, I understood 90% wouldn't have serious and persistent mental health issues, such as you said, but in terms of mental health issues, I've seen statistics that, you know, some extremely large percentage of offenders have some sort of mental health issue, even if not the serious and persistent kind that we're measuring against. And so, you know, you had the comment before that, that there's probably better mental health treatment in custody than they might receive in the community. But I guess I'm concerned that that may be more of a reflection of the deficiency in the community than it is the value, you know, the things being done here. So I'm concerned. I understand the standard of serious and persistent mental illness is a trigger, but I guess I get worried that there's a lot of folks who may be just outside that standard, if you can comment on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative, don't hear us wrong. We need more mental health treatment in our facilities. Those who have the biggest need are getting services, but we know that we can do it better. And so you will hear about a request that we have for additional funding that includes not only behavioral health staff, but also security staff needed to help with getting these folks who have some significant mental illness and some violent tendencies out of their cells into programming so that they can get the services that they need, that we can deliver them more comprehensively mm-hmm. to those who need them. And that includes the seriously and persistently mentally ill folks who make up 11% of our population, but also others who have other mental illness.
And so, Mr. Chair, yes, I'll just close with a comment that I think if we had the same situation when it would come to physical health as we have with mental health, we probably would have addressed it a lot earlier. But because it is hidden, and yet in many ways has probably even more of an impact than the equivalent mental, physical health issues, it's been easier to not do that. So I'm delighted to hear that you're going to be pushing for that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to add a little bit, if you recall from our last presentation, we gave an average number of previous offenses for our population. And if you recall, the average is 4 felonies and 10 offenses overall. I think one could make the argument that the cognitive choice of a life that involves so many crimes could be related overall to mental illness, making those kinds of choices often. And that is our challenge, to break that repetitive repeat offender. And the numbers I told you during our last presentation, we see far too many people coming back, and often they're coming back because of chemical dependency and mental health issues.
Thank you.
Commissioner, what's the average amount of time that an offender spends in our state prison once they get there,
Chair.
Overall?
Mr. Chair, I think in our last presentation that is going to be to my left in a moment, we had a comprehensive chart that showed the release timing 0 to 6 months, 6 months to a year, and
the reason I'm asking is that everybody wants to pour money into mental health, and I don't have anything against that. In fact, it's probably a good idea, but we get people screwed up when they come to prison terribly, and we're expected to turn them around with this mental health in the short time that you have them. I think it's that's where we got to draw the line. How much money are we going to stick in there for the short amount? What effect can we have to actually change their life when they come in there with 5 felonies and numbers of incarcerations already? So mental health treatment sounds good, but we've got to look at these recent studies that show what effect it actually has on recidivism. So,
and Mr. Chair, related to that, we clearly recognize that only treatment inside of prison doesn't do it. The continuity of that treatment as they go out the door and continue in the community is very important, especially when you consider that half of the offenders that come into our facility are doing time under 6 months, 18% 7 to 12 months, 13% 13 to 24 months, and more than 2 years, 20%. And the average length of stay for new court commitments is 3 years. So if you recall, I used the word churn, 8,000 intakes and about 8,000 releases every year. And your comment about the shortness of time is a big challenge for us. And actually, we reconstructed a chemical dependency program, lengthened the duration of that shortened the duration of that treatment program primarily for the reason that you said. We don't have you for that long, but we're going to give it a try.
Representative Considine, I didn't mean to be flippant when I talked about studies before, but the struggles I've had is you get a study from Humphrey Institute, American Standard, I bet you a dozen think tanks, and some of them contradict each other. So I was trying to get to the bottom of this most recent one that was a study of not only our prison, but in prisons nationwide, all sorts of data over the last, I think, was it a couple of years? And then they came to some of these assumptions. So I'd like to share that with you so we can compare that to other studies, too. Representative Considine. And then Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm aware that they often sometimes contradict themselves. And I've also retired in 2010, so new ones have come out. But back to the mental health question, even if they're in there for a short duration and they can stabilize them on medications and things, you're going to make the prison a lot safer for the staff.
True. I don't mean give up on them all together.
I'm not talking about curing them. I'm just saying that, you know, even just stabilizing them, and then you also impact the seclusion, solitary confinement thing, too. Yeah.
Representative Hillsburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that actually transitions nicely to my line of questioning. So once we get an offender stabilized and we get them on proper medication, we have them for a short period of time, and then we discharge them. When they walk out the door, how much medication or prescriptions do they have to have the ability to continue with the medication that you have found that they needed?
I believe we have somebody with the answer to that. Your name and title, and begin, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections. Representative Hillstrom, we actually will give them whatever is remaining in their supply. So we generally keep all of the psychotropic medications, and they are administered in what we call directly observed therapy. So we'll give them whatever is remaining in their blister card, and then if they have a condition that is serious and persistent, we will give them at least another 30 days of medication, and then we give them a prescription as well. If you recall, we have release planners who work specifically with our serious and persistent mentally ill population. We also have them embedded in some of our treatment programs. And their purpose is to ensure continuity of care. So they get them enrolled in health insurance programs. They make appointments for them with community providers. And then they ensure that they have the medications that they need once they walk out the doors.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're telling me that right now you're fine, and that every single person who is getting the treatment that they need in custody has what they need when they leave, so that they have enough medication so they can get to see the doctor when they're on the outside to continue the medication that you have found that they needed.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, for those offenders who are most in need, we ensure that they have what they need when they walk out the door. Are we hitting everybody? No, because not. We only have a certain number of release planners, and they can't focus. I mean, they don't have the capacity to touch every single offender as they walk out the door. But we do what we can. We also have medical release planners. We only have two of them right now, but they also do the same function. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's been testimony that we treat about 30%. What percent do you believe has a planner or has the proper plan? Because you can't touch everyone. What percentage of the population do you believe you actually serve?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, our release planning services are voluntary. So if the offender refuses, which they have a right to do, there's not a whole lot that we can do about that. So I would say that probably 1,000 offenders get these comprehensive release planning services. However, Deputy Commissioner Solheid also spoke about the transition classes that case management and our reentry folks are responsible for. Those services also include things like enrolling into a health insurance program, you know, following up on some of your medical issues. There's some public health in there as well. So they are also getting some services. But can we touch all of the people that we absolutely need to know?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just am trying to get a sense of how big of a gap we have in the event we have the opportunity to fill any of it. And then the last question that I have related to those that are being released is we are seeing that heroin, opioid overdoses are killing a large number of people. And now there is a medication that some of the jails are starting to offer to inmates, which is a shot that will take care of 30 days. Do you provide that option for folks who have opioid addictions as they're leaving to assist in their transition out to the community, or is that just something that's going on at the local jails?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, good question. So opioid addictions and medication-assisted treatment is really becoming a hot topic out there. There are a couple of medications that actually help to treat opiate addictions, methadone, Vivitrol, Suboxone. And we, if somebody comes to us on methadone, we will try and keep them on methadone throughout their stay, but it's usually pregnant women. We do have some concern about referring or about starting medication-assisted treatment while they're inside. There's a cost to Vivitrol, for example. It's about $1,300 for that monthly shot. And will there be the follow-through? Because it's up to the offender then to go to the clinic to get the shot in the next month and the next month. West Virginia actually did a study. It was very small. They had about 10 offenders, but only one out of that 10 followed through once they got out. We have a much smaller opiate addiction problem in Minnesota than they do on the coasts. We do identify at intake what the drug of choice is, and we've identified that only about 8% of our population claims opiate addiction as their addiction of choice. So it's a little bit less of a problem for us than it is on the coasts. And then, of course, methadone is a daily regimen, so there's lots of follow-through issues.
Mr. Chair, last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the next budget going to have any requests to deal with any of these release planning issues? I just don't know if that's in the budget.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, we don't have a request specifically for medication-assisted treatment. We have requests, however, for enhanced mental health services.
Okay, ma'am, you used a couple of terms while you were talking. You said those who have serious and persistent problems, and then those most in need. Give us some layman's terms of what you mean. What would be a serious and persistent versus a problem you weren't so worried about?
Mr. Chair, so serious and persistent mental illness is a statutorily defined term. There are four mental health diagnoses that are included in that, but it also includes things like homelessness. It includes hospitalizations. So if you've had all of those, it would be considered seriously mentally ill. Yep, schizophrenia, bipolar, major depressive disorder. Those are the kinds of diagnoses. Yeah, personality disorder. Thank you. So that would be that. But then we also have other offenders who are, you know, depressed because they're in prison, and I get that. And they need to be monitored and provided treatment as they go throughout their incarceration. We've got lots of antisocial personality disorders. You know, we've got lots of schizophrenia. But they might not all rise to the level of serious and persistent mental illness. So those would be some that we would consider in need.
Do some people leave where you just have a hope that something isn't going to go wrong because they've opted out for no probation and served their sentence, but they're still going out with a lot of problems? Or are you able to network anyway with the outside agency and say, this person's coming out with some real problems, and if you don't monitor him, he or she is going to turn into something else?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. If they are leaving us on expiration, so they're not going to be on paper in the community any longer, and they are working with one of our comprehensive release planners, doesn't matter if they're leaving us on expiration or supervised release. We will try and make those connections, and particularly those ones who are leaving us on expiration, we worry about.
Mm-hmm. Representative O'Neill, did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that in layman's terms, a severe and persistent or serious and persistent mental illness is looked at least in the therapy community, at least when I was doing that, it was more of a lifelong condition. You're not going to just wake up and not have schizophrenia or a bipolar disorder or a personality disorder, something that's very severe, and it's a lifelong struggle. So that's why I continually say, you know, let's categorize over here severe and persistent mental illness, because we're talking about people that it's kind of like having diabetes. You're probably, if you're a type 1 diabetic, you're probably always going to be a type 1 diabetic. Unless they can correct me if I'm incorrect. But, and then the mental health is maybe an episodal. Maybe it's they've gone through a really rough patch. They went through a tremendous loss, grieving, and that's piled on top of other life events. It could be an episodal kind of thing that challenges their mental health. And so that's why I continue to say we need to look at severe and persistent mental illness a little bit differently than we look at the whole breadth of mental health, because they are very, very different in how you approach it and how you understand their lifelong illness. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's really an important distinction when we're talking about the population, which is why I kept asking about those that are in confinement, you know, what percentage of those are severe and persistent, because they might have a really bad mental health day, as Representative Considine probably knows all about, and end up in solitary. They will stabilize. They will, through medication, they can get through that, but then there's other issues as well. So that's why I continue to bring that up, because you really have to look at them as quite a bit different in how you approach it and what you do and what you do in the community and things like that.
Thank you. Any more questions? Mm-hmm. When are we having them back? Thanks, Matt. We're having you come back for the deep dive into the budget and the explanation of the deficiency and how we got there, and your budget requests, things like that, line by line. So thank you very much for your presentation today, and look forward to having you back.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you sure? It must be on the grill about every other week here. And I'll try to bring back those summary sheets for first results, wherever they are, and maybe we can talk about them.
Mr. Chair, do you expect to have a presentation on the first results report? Or is some other committee doing that?
If we get time, it would be interesting, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, meeting adjourned.